It's Sunday, March 12th, 2006. Still hungover from Winterfest.
Almost live from the Fuking Ionosphere, it's the Pirates Week with Ragnar Danisjold.
Well, I am Ragnar Danisjold, and you are listening to The Pirates Week, a podcast serving the shortwave pirate radio community. We take a look into the past week's pirate radio activity, what's going on over at the Free Radio Network, an odd tech tip or two, general free radio and DXing news, the propagation forecast, throw in a little Podsafe music, and, well, I call it The Pirates Week. This really kind of comes down to whatever I stumble across, you know, in a course of a week that's somewhat related to pirate shortwave or DXing news. And it has been a busy 2 weeks. It's last week really did not put out a Pirates Week. Was at the Winterfest with all the other Pookin slobs and had a good time. Came down with a bit of a head cold, which kind of curtailed a lot of the partying that I was planning on doing. Kind of hung out in the room a little more than I expected to, just because I didn't want to get everybody sick. But looking at the fest mailing list, I wasn't the only one that was coming down with a cold. It looks like the little viruses were hopping person to person, pretty much everybody that was there. Got a ton of good audio for you from the fest. Don't have enough time to put all of it into this podcast. Gonna have to space it out over the next week or two or three. But just as a warning, I have a lot of stuff to cover this podcast. We're going to try to keep the music to a minimum just so we can reduce the file size a little bit. This is going to be a long Pirates Week. Got a lot of good stuff to cover. Got some pirates in the news. Got a lot of fest audio I want to throw at you. Got some interesting things going on with the sun hitting solar minimum. And just like I said, got a whole lot of stuff we're going to cover. So, once again, this is going to be a little bit more like the normal Pirates Week, not typical, just because of length and audio stuff I want to throw at you. But it should be fun, so hold on. Let's get right into, with that out of the way, Pirates in the News. Well, first up, we have a news story that was first covered on this podcast about 2 weeks ago. This is coming from an article found on Cracker's website. Portland Radio Authority, a FM pirate broadcasting in Portland, Oregon, was asked by the FCC to pull the plug. PRA was on the air for 3.5 years and is now off air. This is coming from an open letter from the operator of PRA. He says, "I think I should first set some facts straight. We believe that the recent visit by the FCC was a direct result of an interview that I did with a contributing writer to the Oregonian's A&E section. It had nothing to do with any previous PDX, WW, or Mercury stories, publications we have come to trust over the years. This interview was agreed upon with the understanding that the PRA could not mention in publication as wide read as the Oregonian. The facts were that we were pirates and did broadcast on the FM dial. The writer agreed to these terms and I met with him for an interview. I was open with him about how and why we did what we did in order to give him enough information to dance around taboo subjects. It was my understanding that the article would focus on our internet radio streaming capabilities. Why this writer chose to publish that we were pirates and broadcasting FM, I do not know. I'm sure his intentions were to help and not to hinder, but we do feel stabbed in the back." This, of course, is coming from the PRA manager. He continues, "The PRA is well aware of the risks involved, preventative methods, and history of the FCC responses when it comes to pirate radio. Although we appreciate your suggestion as to our immediate predicament and future, I cannot comment on. Thank you for understanding and stay tuned. We may need help." And that is the PRA's manager's response to the FCC's recent visit. In all fairness, I will admit that I did cover the news story a couple weeks ago from the Oregonian in that the PRA management references. I believe that the interview PRA did with the Oregonian was consensual. It now appears the Oregonian reporter published sensitive information about the pirate FM station that was apparently agreed upon not to be published and only to be used for background information. I truly hope that my podcast has not contributed to the fact that the station was visited by the FCC. However, I will continue to relay news stories that is widely available to the public at large here on the Pirates Week podcast. Well, that goes to show you that as pirates, do not talk to the media. Your best defense against an FCC visit is anonymity. Well, that is our one and only news story for this week.
Now here's something we hope you'll really like.
Well, it's time once again to head on over to the Free Radio Network, www.frn.net/vines, to take a look at some of the more informative posts over the last 2 weeks this time, starting off with Pirate Shortwave. QRP posted a simple circuit using a small ferrite ring and a LED to detect the presence of RF. Great for small areas where a meter won't fit. DC2 Daylight posts a question on what the CW key down power should be on a Knight T60. IO replies that 30 watts is about right. Radio 33 and Cracker supplies links to a site that supplies tubes for the Knight. Captain Pinga Loca asks where to get started in pirate radio. The poet sends him to the Pirate Radio Survival Guide found at www.frn.net/special/PRSG. Doctor Who posts that the Rat Shack has RG-8 on a clearance sale. Doctor Who also posts about frequencies 13.950 or 14.000, wondering if they are okay for experimentation. Grasscutter says that 14000 is a ham band. Consensus seems to be that these freaks are not so good for domestic broadcasting, but they may make the hop to Europe or Africa. Gonna have to look a little bit more into that. I may have an idea. Anyways, continuing on, Bouncer posts a link to a eBay auction of 30-watt AM transmitter. Auction ends today, Sunday, so hurry, or at least go and see what it's sold for. Al Phantom posts a news story that Radio St. Helena back on the air on shortwave. DykeMap asks why ops use USB versus LSB. Seems it may just come down to monkey see, monkey do. The Decapitator posts a link on linking computer power supplies together, 13.8 volts, 80 amps. QSLs have been received lately from both Undercover Radio and the Commander Bunny. Scribb76Dragon04 is looking into buying an FM transmitter. He is looking at the 12-watt self-powered Veronica FM and wondering if it's good enough. The Decapitator says get a PLL transmitter and check out the kits from NRG. Cracker sends him to a J-Poll website. A couple people posted that they like my website. Cracker says not too bad for a white guy. Oh, thanks guys, and if you haven't been over to shortwavepirate.info lately, you should stop by and see the Winterfest editions. It's worth the time and I don't know, I think it's pretty good. Got a lot of audio downloads there, but we'll talk a little more about that later in the podcast. Continuing on with Shortwave Pirate on the FRN, AM posts that recently 7 MHz has been quite long at night, but 3 and 4 MHz has been very hot for low power signals. Doctor Who posts that he has a 6940 and 69 crystal, but wonders if the 6910 is too close to the Mars frequencies. Pigmeat says FEMA normally will be up and around 6918 in hurricane season, but with Skip going long in the evenings the past couple of years, he hasn't heard them in quite a while. Looking over at the low power FM section of the FRN, Eric Blair posts, wondering if the forum is dead. Well, that's the only post that's been there in a while. And on the swap shop section, HV Transformer posts that he has 8 to 12 volt 13 amp power supplies pulled from military equipment, very compact, $40 each. HV also posts a Elinco DX77T for sale, good conditions, $450 or best offer, and also a 6900 TBF. Make him a reasonable offer, and it's yours. And that's all that's going on of note on the FRN this last week or so. As always, I have no affiliation with the FRN other than just a regular reader. Well, let's now get into some of the audio that I recorded at the SWL Winterfest in Culpsville, Pennsylvania. First up, and heads up for all you guys that have been listening to pirate radio, at least back as far back as the 80s, I ran into a group of guys that came to the fest. They were a film crew doing a indie movie of sorts about a topic that did have a pirate radio connection. These guys stumbled across a bunch of linoleum tiles, you know, several feet by several feet, that were placed in streets, many major U.S. cities, and now apparently large cities around the world. They were apparently associated with pirate radio, shortwave pirate radio broadcasts, and that was broadcasted about in the same time back in the 80s. Let's take a quick listen to some audio I got from these guys.
Some people that were talking to us, the reason that we're here is because we've met some people who said, well, you know, in Philadelphia in the 80s, we remember seeing some posters up on bus stops and stuff with this message on it, and they referred to a shortwave radio broadcast. So
you've been tracking these guys for a while?
Oh man, I've been on this 20BIDS stuff for about 10 years. Took linoleum tiles and they cut the message into them and put them in the street and they're permanent. So, you know, 10 years go by and it's still there. And it's pretty amazing, but the person that's done it has never taken credit for it. And that's the mystery of it. We're trying to figure out who made these things and was placing them for 10 years, and there's hundreds of them, and they're in different cities and, you know, everything else. So.
What was the website?
It's resurrectdead.com.
Resurrectdead.com?
Yeah. What
we were really hoping for was the godsend thing would be for somebody to go, oh, yeah, I know those broadcasts. You know, everybody knows the Toynbee Idea guys, you know, or whatever, but...
Yeah, I wish that would be the case,
yeah.
Because it would be perfect for shortwave.
Yeah, that's what I thought too when I heard it, because I listen to shortwave sometimes, and it just seems like something you would catch, you know, right between Brother Stare and, you know, whatever. But.
ResurrectDead.com, ResurrectDead.com was the website. If you know anything about these tiles placed in the streets with weird and obscure messages in them back in the 80s, and the pirate broadcast that went with them, these guys would really want to talk to you. Go ahead and take a look at their website, resurrectdead.com. Like I said, we had quite a bit of audio generated when I went to the Shortwave Listening Fest in Culpsville. One of the highlights was the Alan Wiener Worldwide broadcast that they did. He's, of course, on WBCQ. He did from his hotel room 412. I captured pretty much the entire hour broadcast that can be downloaded from my website. A little bit more on that later. But I thought we'd take a listen to some of the highlights as he discussed pirate radio and shortwave pirate radio specifically. Let's take a listen to Alan's broadcast, or at least parts of it. This is about 9 minutes in length. Told you this was going to be a long podcast, but it's really good information. Let's take a listen to Alan Weiner Worldwide.
Captain Gunja.
Yes.
Come forward.
Hey, yeah.
Come on down.
Come on down. Now, behind this door... Okay.
Officer Kelly of the FBI, you are busted.
By the way, for those of you, Captain Gunja has made an incredible transformation.
Yeah.
Physically. I mean, he has turned into one lean, mean pirate machine.
Yeah. Rock and roll.
As far as health is concerned and whatever,
yes,
hats off to you. Been. Round of applause.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Nice guys,
I love it.
Anyway, one thing I want to do is...
Yeah.
All right, well, a subject near and dear to my heart is, of course, free radio.
Yes.
Or as we affectionately know, pirate radio. And for those that have just tuned into this station, please realize, folks, that WBCQ, the foundation of WBCQ has been numerous free radio stations.
Exactly.
On land and on sea. And everyone that has worked at this station has definitely gone through the school of hard FCC knocks.
And, yeah.
And it took a long time to get BCQ on the air, which I can affectionately say is the nation's only true licensed pirate. And I say that with all the affection and all the effort that... So many have died to put this thing. No,
yes.
There's been a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. There really have. And it took us all a long time. And I could go on. I could take the whole show thanking the people. And I really also has to. I'm not brown nosing, but I really do have to thank the FCC because they have been very good to the station. They've been amazingly cooperative and that's good. But with the help of my lawyer and consultant. But let's get to free radio. First of all,
it's still there. It still exists, but there's a lot less of it.
Okay. Before we get to pirate radio in this country, can someone give me the definition of a true pirate radio station? Come on.
No license.
What?
Unlicensed.
Okay. No government interference whatsoever.
Okay.
No,
what?
Hold on.
No government interference whatsoever.
Okay. Any other definitions?
Totally free speech.
Totally free speech. Okay.
Build your own from scratch.
Build your own from scratch. Sounds like BCQ so
far.
Any other definitions?
Well, BCQ is not a grenade with an antenna thrown up in the trees.
True. This is true. Gunja, what do you think at this moment in time is the state of American free radio, American pirate radio?
I think it's died down a bit since the 90s. It was like more at its peak, like, say, from like, mid to late 80s to about 96 or 97.
Why would somebody, with like the internet and podcasting and everything that's going on now, why would somebody, get a transmitter? Let's take shortwave. Why would somebody get a transmitter and go on, like 6955 or whatever, basically risk, I mean, the wrath of the government can be bad. I mean, there's big fines and there's jail time and all that. So why would they do it? The rush?
Yeah, for me it was the rush and knowing I'm getting away with something I shouldn't be doing.
So it's like a radio high.
Yeah, it was like a radio high. Yeah. And it don't hurt anybody.
I know that radio high.
As much as it bugged the FCC at one time, it does not hurt anybody. And pirates try not to interfere.
Most, but there are some.
Okay. There are some.
So it's a rush. What about content?
A lot of it can be a lot more creative.
You think so?
Yeah, but although some, you think there's a lot of free
pirates that get on the air just to kind of play music
and some will do that.
Frustrated broadcasters.
You got some like that too. Some just want to play, FM jock, basically.
Now, I as a licensed broadcaster, I know I laugh about that sometimes, but as a licensed broadcaster, I cannot in any way, shape, or form, get on the air here and encourage anyone to go and break the law and put on your own transmitter. But we were talking about this at the Free Radio Forum this morning. There seems to be a need. I think that's like the whole crux of free radio, is that people have a need in their community. People have sometimes a political need, which turns into a clandestine. Yeah. You have like your major cities that it's impossible to get an FM station in New York City licensed and legal is virtually impossible, and to find anything on the AM band is impossible because there's no channels left except if you go a little bit up here or you find an unused free channel in between on a non-interference basis because you're running a few watts.
There's almost more of a need than ever before. We were watching the old videos downstairs.
That's Steve Colletti.
Steve Colletti was doing a presentation of old videos and films about radio. And what really hit home to me, especially in the one about NBC and WMCA, they were talking about how multiple opinions from the community were solicited. The fairness doctrine. Limitations on commercials. Mm-hmm. The idea that radio was supposed to be a community service. Well, you know what? That's gone. There are no limitations on ownership. Right. We can hear Clear Channels programs on hundreds of radio stations. Mm-hmm. And there's no way for alternate opinions to get on the media.
And especially now, because radio properties in the cities are worth, fractions of $1 billion. I mean, a major metropolitan, like New York City FM station, got to be worth $250 million. If it ever went up for sale. And so getting access to that market by, a small interest group or the Russians or Chinese or Koreans or whatever is virtually impossible. And buying time on a major commercial station is got to be either impossible or against policy or cost prohibitive.
Future predictions. I want a future prediction from someone. Someone raise their hand. Okay, go.
I really don't think that radio is in definite danger, but I don't think it's in danger from the government per se. I think it's in danger from other sources such as the internet. Mm-hmm. I see, at least with ham radio, as a person who listens to the repeaters, activities becoming less and less. People are listening less and less to radio and doing more and more on the computer with podcasting and the ability to download shows and listen to radio on demand. I think that the radio industry is in definite danger. Not only from internet radio, but from the satellite radio as well. And they've never been able to, they could have not been able to figure out why, and they've lost the ball.
I've got a comment.
All right, go.
As far as that goes, one of these days, God forbid, the whole network crashes, what's going to be left? The radio signal? You can't stop it.
Ooh, that happened. That happened in New Orleans.
Didn't it?
Yeah, when that disaster
when Hurricane Katrina
came rolling through, it's very interesting that the only radio that managed to get in there was AM and shortwave.
Simple technology
seems to work the best. Yeah.
But the problem is that the capitalist cultural elite don't want those minority groups to have access to the airwaves. They don't want those people to have a voice. They don't want people to be able to communicate the message of free speech and what they're trying to say, because the governments are run by that white capitalist cultural elite. I'm sorry, but the rest of the planet, we don't have an access and a voice for opinions other than the governments and the people in power. And it's about power, keeping power and maintaining power. And the airwaves are power. It gives people power. It gives people a voice.
Yes.
Power to be heard, to be listened to propagate their message, no matter what it be. And freedom of expression, freedom of speech, is you should have the freedom to express your ideas, and you can take them or leave them. That's what America is about, isn't it?
Whoa, absolutely.
Well, as I said, that was recorded live from room 412 with my little iRiver T30, Alan's WBCQ broadcast, Alan Wiener Worldwide. I have a whole lot more audio from the fest that I will be playing in the next couple weeks to come. One of the things Alan did say during his broadcast there that he thought the FCC should have a area of spectrum set aside for radio hobbyists that would be pirate radio, but if the FCC allowed it, they'd no longer be pirates. And that theme kind of continued on. And what was interesting in this last week's This Week in Amateur Radio that came out earlier today, there was a musing from W2XOY Bill Continelli's pretty much saying the exact same thing. Let's take a listen to Bill's commentary on what he thinks could be done with allowing the pirates some bandwidth for experimentation.
On Friday, March 3rd, I sat in my kitchen and listened to WBCQ on 7415 kilohertz, broadcasting live from the Shortwave Fest in Culpsville, Pennsylvania. Alan Weiner was interviewing our own Bill Barron, N2FNH, who was giving his ideas on free radio and the FCC. I also heard my friend Jeff Bennett, WA2AIB, chime in with his opinions. Well, I wasn't there, but thanks to This Week in Amateur Radio, I can also put in my 2 cents, or at least my 10 minutes. Pirate radio fans are always seeking an available AM, FM, or shortwave frequency to set up their stations. Unfortunately, there is very little space left on the broadcast bands. Even if the pirate or free broadcaster found space, there is always the risk of being caught by the FCC, having to pay a hefty fine, losing your amateur license, and having your equipment confiscated. From the FCC's point of view, they have to pay engineers to find and close the stations, as well as the administrative costs involved, should the station request a hearing. It's a no-win situation. So why not just set aside a group of frequencies for the free radio advocates to use? What you say? There's nothing available? But there is, and it's already allocated to broadcasting. It's the 11-meter band. No, I don't mean CB. I mean the 11-meter broadcast band, which runs from 25.6 to 26.1 megahertz. That's 500 kilohertz of unused spectrum space. Even during the sunspot maximum, these frequencies are underutilized. So, give these frequencies to free radio advocates. There would have to be some basic rules to ensure maximum effectiveness and order. First, the stations would use 25 watts in the AM mode. Antennas would have to be omnidirectional, either a vertical dipole or a quarter-wave ground plane. Antenna height would be limited to 20 feet above the building or structure on which it was mounted. Channel spacing would be 10 kilohertz, making 50 frequencies available. Stations on the same channel would be spaced at least 75 miles apart. Adjacent channel separation would be 20 miles, and 20 kilohertz separation would be 10 miles. I estimate that this would give a practical range of 10 to 15 miles, assuming a typical shortwave receiver such as the Eaton E10 or the Grundig Yachtboy 400. Even in years of high sunspot activity, the useful range would be about 2 miles, more than enough to cover a small town, village, or community. The FCC would not license these stations. Instead, volunteer frequency coordinators would assign the channels to applicants. Call signs would be simple: W, east of the Mississippi, and K, west of the Mississippi, followed by the owner's first, middle, and last initial, and the zip code. For example, my name is William Lewis Continelli. Therefore, I would be WWLC-12144. Stations would have to be locally owned and operated by an individual only, with 75% of the programming of local origin. The station would be non-profit, but could sell airtime. The frequency coordinator would collect an initial fee of $150. $50 of this would go to the coordinating official for coordinating the frequency, and then $100 would be sent to the FCC along with the owner information, frequency, and call sign. Every year, the owner would renew the license with the FCC for a fee of $100. While $100 sounds steep, it pays for the FCC to enforce the frequency coordination. Besides, the owner can sell airtime. Thus, the FCC's role is merely keeping records of who is on what frequency and enforcing the coordinated channels. The FCC makes out also. Assuming 200 stations per channel times 50 channels, that's a potential of 10,000 stations. At $100 per year, that's $1 million annually for the FCC. Part 73 of the FCC rules would have to be modified to allow this. The FCC can do it if they want and if there is sufficient interest. Now, just how practical is this idea? First, the cost. A 25-watt AM transmitter on 11 meters with a frequency tolerance of 0.002% would cost maybe $150, based on current CB prices. The antenna, maybe $100. Audio equipment, maybe $200 to $300 gets you what you need. Add a computer and a phone line, and you're in at about $1,000. Now, add in the total of the frequency coordination and call sign, and you're at a total of about $1,150. Second, audience. There's always a market for community radio. That's why pirates thrive. With a 10 to 15 mile range during sunspot minimum, there's a potential of hundreds of thousands of listeners. Even limited to only 2 miles at sunspot maximum, there's still the ability to reach 20,000 or more people. Radios that cover the 25.6 to 26.1 megahertz range are widely available. Radio Shack stocks 3 models that receive this range. Many other companies sell shortwave radios that have 11 meters. Third, freedom and simplicity. The FCC is out of the application loop. No 50,000-watt station, no directional antennas, no complicated application process. Just pick a frequency, send it to the frequency coordinator with $150, and as long as you are a local individual, you're in. Stay on frequency, keep it to 25 watts, pay your $100 per year, and keep 75% of your programming local, and you are set for life. So, what do you think? Do you like it? Do you hate it? Would you set up your own station? What kind of programming would you have? Email me and give me your thoughts. I'll read them on the air. My email address is w2xoy@twiar.org. This is Bill Continelli, W2XOY, future WWLC 12144, for This Week in Amateur Radio. See you on 11 meters.
Well, let's take a look now at some other radio news like we typically do and get away from the fest just for a little bit. This is coming from the AR Newsline, 2 stories of unauthorized radio broadcasts. They call them pirates, but these ain't pirates. Both stories are about idiots broadcasting fake maritime distress calls. First one is coming from the East Coast. Somewhere between St. Augustine, Florida and New Smyrna, Georgia, these phony radio calls starting on Thursday, March 2nd. Each one claimed that boats were sinking. After the calls, Coast Guard and Navy crews spent hours searching for damaged vessels using planes, helicopters, and boats. The second story is on the West Coast. 2 Oregon teenagers who faked maritime distress calls last October must serve jail time and pay restitution to the Coast Guard. One teen was convicted of 4 counts of disorderly conduct and will serve 32 days in juvenile hall. He also was placed on probation and ordered to pay $53,233 to the Coast Guard. The second teen was convicted of disorderly conduct and will serve 8 days in juvie. He received probation and will pay $10,650 in restitution. This pair of idiots made distress calls from handheld radios on shore. The first hoax call-in came from October, and the pair claimed to be on a disabled recreational boat. 2 Coast Guard lifeboats and 1 helicopter spent 9 hours searching the waters for a disaster that didn't exist. 2 similar calls came later in the month. During those searches, the Coast Guard deployed 47-foot lifeboats, 25-foot response boat, and 3 land units. Now, what burns me on these 2 stories is the AR Newsline, and that the AR Newsline is calling these idiots pirates. Pirates they ain't, and I think a distinction can be made between radio pirates and a couple idiots, teenagers, yes, but idiots making fake distress calls. They're just, well, they're idiots, but I can't figure out another word to call them. Well, the AR Newsline went on to another story, and I'm going to supply some audio from this about the SWL Fest. Back to the Fest with the AR Newsline.
Well, it's over and in the books. We're referring to the 19th annual Winter SWL Fest held in Culpsville, Pennsylvania, between March 3rd and the 5th. The Winterfest is the SWL version of Dayton. A large number of attendees are radio amateurs along with others fascinated with the hobby of radio monitoring. Some notable faces this year include Toshi Otaki from Japan, several representatives from China Radio International, and Bob Zanotti of soundsofswitzerland.org. The 2007 Fest dates have already been announced. This will be the 20th Fest, and plans are already starting to take shape to make it even better than the last. We suggest you keep an eye on www.swlfest.com during the year for news of what's on its way in less than 12 months.
Well, it's time for the website of the week, and I'm going to cheat. I am going to supply one section of my website that I talked about a little bit earlier in the podcast, and this is going to be the new Winterfest 06 section that I have uploaded the last few days to my website. There is a link on the front page of shortwavepirate.info that will take you to the new SWL Winterfest 2006 section. And the main page of the Winterfest 2006 section has links to many of the events that happened at Culpsville, namely the forums The Year in Pirate and Clandestine Radio, The Scum Show, SWL Gizmos, the WBCQ broadcast that we had a little bit of audio from earlier in the podcast, also Writing on Radio and Radio Telepathy. Each of these events I had recorded from the Little Eye River, and you can download those recordings and listen to them like you were there. And also, each one of those areas of the Winterfest 2006 page has the pictures that I took with my digital camera of the speakers. I'd really like to highlight the two sections or the two events that I had not only really good audio on, but had some really good content. And those were The Year in Pirate and Clandestine Radio, the forum that was held by Chris Lobdell, also with Alan Wiener and John Fisher supplying their thoughts. Also, that the WBCQ broadcast, and I got a whole bunch of pictures from that broadcast, and that was a whole lot of fun. That was probably the highlight of the entire trip. You really want to take a look at Tim Tron when he was snoring. Got a good picture of him catching 40 winks during the broadcast, asleep at the switch, so to speak. From the Winterfest 2006 page I've put up, I also have links to, well, the SWL Fest homepage, but also the Pancho Villa homepage, which has its links to all their pictures, and they got a whole lot of good pictures, and the Pancho Villa broadcast, the De-Expedition to Feedback Mountain, that I really think you should download and listen to. Really good stuff there. The De-Expedition to Feedback Mountain, the Pancho Villa Pirate Radio broadcast, broadcasted there at Culpsville. And also I have a bunch of random recordings off air from the five or six pirate radio, FM pirate radios that was going on different frequencies, 88.9, 91.0. I can't remember all the different frequencies that was going on, but there was a bunch of them, you know, for those people in the know. But anyways, like I said, that's the website of the week. Once again, my website, or at least a section of my website that I've put up for Winterfest 2006. Enjoy, everybody. I really hope you take a look at it and take a look at some of the pictures and download a bunch of the audio. Well, let's now get into the propagation forecast. Before we do the actual forecast, I'd like to share a news story with you. From Science at NASA comes a news story that we are at the solar minimum and the coming solar maximum cycle. Now, I've edited this for time, but the entire story can be seen at science.nasa.gov/headlines. I'll put the link, of course, in the show notes with all the rest of the links and all the audio sources that I've been using. take a listen to this. This is really interesting that we have made some, or at least the scientists have made some real advances at predicting long-term solar cycles, you know, a little bit more precisely, especially with the cyclical nature of the sun. Take a listen to this story from Science at NASA.
It's official. Solar minimum has arrived. Sunspots have all but vanished. Solar flares are non-existent. The sun is utterly quiet, like the quiet before a storm. This week, researchers announced that a storm is coming, the most intense solar maximum in 50 years. The prediction comes from a team led by Masumi Dikpati of the National Center for Atmospheric Research. The next sunspot cycle will be 30% to 50% stronger than the previous one, she says. If correct, the years ahead could produce a burst of solar activity second only to the historic solar max of 1958. Now that was a solar maximum. The space age was just beginning. Sputnik was launched in October 1957, and Explorer 1, the first U.S. satellite, in January 1958. In 1958, you couldn't tell that a solar storm was underway by looking at the bars on your cell phone. Cell phones didn't exist. Even so, people knew something big was happening when northern lights were sighted three times, in Mexico. A similar maximum now would be noticed by its effect on cell phones, GPS, weather satellites, and many other modern technologies. Dikpati's prediction is unprecedented. In nearly two centuries since the 11-year sunspot cycle was discovered, scientists have struggled to predict the size of future maxima, and failed. Solar maxima can be intense, as in 1958, or barely detectable, as in 1805, obeying no obvious pattern. The key to the mystery Dikpati realized years ago is a conveyor belt on the sun. The sun's conveyor belt is a current not of water, but of electrically conducting gas. It flows in a loop from the sun's equator to the poles and back again. Just as the Great Ocean conveyor belt controls weather on Earth, this solar conveyor belt controls weather on the sun. Specifically, it controls the sunspot cycle. Solar physicist David Hathaway of the National Space Science and Technology Center explains. First, remember what sunspots are. Tangled knots of magnetism generated by the sun's inner dynamo. A typical sunspot exists for just a few weeks, then it decays, leaving behind a corpse of weak magnetic fields. Enter the conveyor belt. The top of the conveyor belt skims the surface of the sun, sweeping up the magnetic fields of old dead sunspots, he continues. The corpses are dragged down at the poles to a depth of 200,000 kilometers, where the sun's magnetic dynamo can amplify them. Once the corpses, magnetic knots, are reincarnated, amplified, they become buoyant and float back to the surface. Presto, new sunspots. All this happens with massive slowness. It takes about 40 years for the belt to complete one loop, says Hathaway. The speed varies, anywhere from a 50-year pace, in other words slow, to a 30-year pace, or fast. When the belt is turning fast, it means that lots of magnetic fields are being swept up and that some future sunspot cycle is going to be intense. Here we have a basis for forecasting. The belt was turning fast in 1986 through 1996, says Hathaway. Old magnetic fields swept up then should reappear as big sunspots in 2010 through 2011. Like most experts in the field, Hathaway has confidence in the conveyor belt model and agrees with Dikpati that the next solar maximum should be a doozy. But he disagrees with one point. Dikpati's forecast puts solar max at the year 2012. Hathaway believes it will arrive sooner, in 2010 or 2011. History shows that big sunspot cycles ramp up faster than small ones, he says. I expect to see the first sunspots of the next cycle appear in late 2006 or 2007, and solar max to be fully underway by 2010 or 2011. Who's right? Time will tell. Either way, a storm is coming.
Well, now let's get into the actual solar propagation forecast from This Week in Amateur Radio.
Our propagation forecast this week tells us that solar activity continues to remain low, with many recent days of zero sunspots and even more are ahead. The vernal equinox, that is spring, is only a couple of weeks away. This is a good time for HF propagation, even with few sunspots, as the southern and northern hemispheres are equally bathed in the sun's radiation. Friday, March 10th could have unsettled to active conditions, with unsettled conditions on Saturday, quiet to unsettled on Sunday, and quiet on Monday, March 13th.
Well, where are we at? We're at 45 minutes. Wow. Told you this was going to be a long one, but had a lot of good stuff to get through and a whole lot more good stuff that we're going to get to in the next few weeks. A couple closing thoughts on the Winterfest. Like I said, I had a great time there, but one of the real surprises was the fact that, you know, you go to one of those things and you see the itinerary and you're like, God, that's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm going to do this and I'm going to party with these people and the things you plan on doing. But the real gems of the whole Winterfest was the unexpected little nuggets that you stumble into. And those, well, for me, was two separate conversations I had. And the first one was a real interesting conversation I had with Bob Zanotti from the Two Bobs radio show on Switzerland and Sound. And he was there at the fest covering it for his radio program. And that was really fun. We had a lot of interesting conversations about microphones and signal processing and something completely unexpected. And that was a real gem. And I'm hoping to see some really good coverage from the fest at his site in the next week or so. And I suggest you head over to his area there, www.switzerlandinsound.com. And, of course, he was from the Voice of Switzerland, or used to be the Two Bobs program. And the second conversation I had was completely unexpected. That was during the banquet, was with two gentlemen that was completely from a different area of radio listening. One worked in programming a jazz program at a NPR station. And he was sitting alongside a gentleman who, as far as I could tell, sold radio programs to radio stations. And their perspective of the broadcast radio landscape was really interesting and one that I have never really heard. And that was unexpected and a real joy and a real interesting conversation to have. Well, hopefully in 2007, I will be returning to Culpsville. It will be the 20th anniversary of the SWL Fest, and it's planning on being 3 days this time. They're adding an extra day just for all the festivities. So start planning now. It's going to be in March, and I hope to see you there. So let's wrap this puppy up. Oh, hey, before we wrap this puppy up, I do have one more thing to make, and this is kind of an important announcement. This just came through moments ago from the Pirate DXer. As we discussed 2 weeks ago, the Alex from Alex Draper's Pirate Archive has been off air now for more than a month. He had a death in the family that severely restricted the website and brought it off air, and he has no plans on returning to the hobby anytime soon, which was sad news, and several people have emailed me looking for more information about it. Well, the Pirate DXer has just emailed me stating that he is going to take over Alex's website, the piratedxer.com, DX programs area, also the piratearchive.com and the piratearchive.net. He's going to be running that until Alex is ready to return to the hobby, and that is just awesome. I'm really glad that phenomenal resource will not go away, will be brought back to the web. He also goes on to state that his much-anticipated Pirate DXer video podcast should be ready to go really soon, and I am one that has been waiting a very long time, waiting for that to come to fruition. So kudos to the Pirate DXer to take over the reins from Alex for the Pirate Archive website and trying to do the video podcast simultaneously. So we're waiting on that, so kudos to you. So let's wrap this puppy up now. As always, thank you for listening. See you next week, guys.
From the Boat Anchor Soft Glow to your MP3 player via the World Wide Web, we meld the oldest and the newest audio technology. Welcome to the Pirates Week, piratesweek.tripod.com.
You are without doubt the worst pirate I've ever heard of.
But you have heard of me.